The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello and welcome to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is Richard Palmer, contributing editor for Trumpet Magazine, and your guest host today on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Standing in for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Flowing. We're going to start by talking about, we're going to talk about a couple of elections on today's program, elections either side of the channel, big important developments in France, and then also some dangerous aspects of the election in Britain. But we'll start with France. Over the weekend, France had their final round of their presidential vote, and already there are some very striking things that we can see from these, well, from this whole process of elections within France. I think the most a lot of analysts or media coverage has gone is just to kind of breathe a sigh of relief that Marine Le Pen didn't win and move on from that. But this whole election process, it tells us some very important things about France. It tells us some very important things about Europe. It tells us some very important things about what is happening all around the world. Now, one thing that stands out very quickly from the political situation in France is that French politics really are in crisis. At one point, the approval ratings of the now ex-president, François Hollande, hit just 4%. 4%. That made him the most unpopular leader in France's history. Now, back in the day, once you start going back a few years, they didn't have opinion polls. I had a bit of fun looking up actually some names of French kings. They had people like Clovis the Lazy, Charles the Fat, Philip the Amorous. But it's hard to imagine even Louis the Stammerer getting as low as 4% when it comes to an approval rating. So France's ex-president with the lowest approval rating in history. And then in this election, in the runoff vote that we saw on Sunday, it was between candidates. Well, neither of the two candidates came from one of France's main political parties. It's almost as if you had, say, neither the Republicans nor the Democrats as the main contenders in American presidential elections. It's a huge shift. And it's something that goes way beyond just kind of normal political dissatisfaction. It's even reaching revolutionary levels. I think Mr. Stephen Flowey quoted this from Spiegel Online ahead of the election. But they wrote, the French are discussing whether their country's institutions have maneuvered themselves into a pre-revolutionary plight as a result of the continued incompetence of public officials. They wonder whether today's state is in fact more similar to the monarchy of old, to the rotten Ancien Régime, shortly before the French Revolution. They wrote that it's no accident that this election includes a number of candidates who are calling for the abolition of the French Republic in its common form and the creation of a new constitution. Now, the mainstream candidate won, but that doesn't get rid of just that background that we just talked about, the background that's there in France. And he won not so much because people actually like him, but because they wanted to block his rival, Marine Le Pen. And only 24% said that he had the stuff to be president. And actually, 25% said that they thought Le Pen had the stuff to be president. So he was, in that regard, less popular even than Le Pen. One rallying cry was neither Macron nor Le Pen. Another was neither cholera nor the plague. There was a record number of spoiled ballots. I think about 10% of the ballots cast were deliberately spoiled. Very high levels of abstentions. People didn't like either candidate. But it's also worth reflecting just how shocking it is that Marine Le Pen made it through to the second round of the election. Again, the way the French elections work is you have a first round, and if none of the candidates achieve more than 50% in the first round, then the top two go through to the second round. And to have Marine Le Pen finish as one of those top two and then get one third of the votes in the second round of the election is really quite incredible. And to help understand why, here's just a passage from the World Affairs Journal. And they wrote, let's get something out of the way. Marine Le Pen isn't the French Donald Trump. Sure, they're both right-wing populist change agents backed by the Kremlin. Of course, that's a significant overlap. So you can see that they're not Trump fans, this journal, with that slide against Donald Trump there with saying he's backed by the Kremlin. But anyway, the point here is about Le Pen. But he said, but Trump is closer to Dwight D. Eisenhower than he is to Le Pen. For when it comes to authoritarian demagoguery, Americans are amateurs. More than just about anyone else in the world, the Europeans are pros at it. Le Pen's party was founded not by an abolitionist like the Republican Party, but by her father, Jean-Marie, and his clique of Vichy nostalgists, Holocaust deniers, and embittered Pied Noirs from French Algeria. Le Pen-Pierre, the father, famously and repeatedly stated on television that the Nazi gas chambers were a mere detail of history and has never been able to scrub the stench of neo-fascism out of his pores. 2 years ago, Marine forced her father out of the party and tried with some success to detoxify the National Front and rebrand it as one that is anti-European and anti-immigrant rather than quasi-Nazi and anti-Semitic. But as recently as last month, she reverted to form and declared that France is blameless for the roundup and deportation of Jews during World War II. France wasn't responsible for the Val d'Hiv, she said, referring to events in July 1942, when almost 5,000 French police officers, on orders from the government in Paris, arrested thousands of Jews and held them in the Vélodrome de Hiver sports stadium. All, including the children, were later deported by the French authorities to Auschwitz and murdered. Just reading down... She said, this article continues, these events and France's complicity in them are as incontrovertible as the Holocaust itself. The French erected memorials to the victims inside and outside Paris decades ago. Until Le Pen opened her mouth, it wasn't even controversial, certainly not among decent, civilized people. But the National Front is neither decent nor civilized. Just last month, Jean-François Jalques, who denied the Nazis used Zyklon B gas to exterminate Jews, was promoted to replace Le Pen as head of the party. And members of her inner circle have been caught on camera organizing neo-Nazi rallies and waving Iron Cross flags. These people are not conservatives. They aren't extreme conservatives or even pseudo-conservatives. They are something else entirely. Something a lot of us thought had become permanently alien to Western electoral politics. Yet they beat the Conservative Party in the first round of elections. So major upheaval in the French election, an upheaval that's not going to go away just after the election. And really the real test for Macron is going to come on June 11th and June 18th. And this is when France has its parliamentary elections. Now, Macron, he leads a brand new party, and it was founded just over a year ago. To go from zero to a majority in just 1 year seems like an impossible task. It seems more likely that Macron is going to be, right from the start of his time in office, a lame duck president, and one confronted with monumental challenges in France's position in the world. And if that plays out, if he doesn't gain a majority there, well, it's quite likely that the record along set for unpopularity won't last all that long. Now, one of the big challenges Macron is faced with is economic. France has major economic problems. Its unemployment is over 10%. It's close to the highest level it's had in 35 years. By way of comparison, Germany's unemployment rate is under 4%. Meanwhile, youth unemployment, 25%. One in four French young people who are willing and able to work can't find a job. Their economy is barely growing. During the second quarter of last year, it actually shrunk. Now, a lot of France's problem is it can't borrow its way out of the mess the way that Britain and America have done repeatedly. Now, I think they're in a bit of a deeper mess in some ways than those two countries. But Britain and America have at least the option of borrowing as much as they want. And those ballooning debts, they can solve a lot of the short-term headaches while building up problems down the road. But France is part of the euro, and eurozone rules limit the amount that the government can borrow each year. And France's borrowing is already maxed out. And this is a big part of the reason why France has had such a big backlash against the euro. In the first round of the elections, 48%, nearly half of voters voted for parties that want out of the euro. And again, that so many would be so against the status quo shows the level of unsatisfaction in France right now. The level of unsatisfaction with the euro, it's an indication of the major changes coming within Europe. And you see the same thing in Italy. They're in a similar situation. If you had an election, it's quite possible that a coalition of parties that want Italy out of the euro could win. And it stems from fundamental problems in the way the euro is set up. It means sharing sovereignty, but it was never sold to voters like that. And so you can understand why the French, the Spanish, the Greeks, etc., why they're upset when the German government says, well, nope, you can't do this economic policy that you want to do. You can't do this. You can't borrow this money. You know, they kind of feel, whether even they agree with the policy of borrowing money or not, they feel, well, why is Germany telling us what to do? And at the same time, well, Germany's quite understandably upset that other countries are amassing all of this debt and that these other countries that they can't really control are imperiling their own economy. That you get countries across southern Europe and France are borrowing way too heavily in their opinion, and then that their economy is at risk. And they want to make sure that German taxpayer money doesn't go to bailing out the mistakes of other countries. So you can see why the Germans want to control what these other countries are doing. You can see why these countries don't want German control. Because that's the nature of a currency union. It's going to involve that kind of shared sovereignty and shared destiny. But voters were never informed of that, and they never approved it. So Macron, to try and fix France's economic situation, really he has... Well, he's going for a two-pronged approach. So firstly, France's... its whole kind of legal system and regulatory system is a complete mess. Ambrose Evans-Pritchard, the international business editor at The Telegraph, he recently wrote, the labyrinthine legal system has 400,000 business norms and regulations with 360 separate taxes, some predating the French Revolution. There was an expert at, I think it was UBS, I should have noted that down, but one of the big banks, it says, as the saying goes, it takes 3 days to fire somebody in London, 3 months in Switzerland, and 3 years in Paris. It may be an exaggeration, but it's probably quite close to reality. And this is what's stopping a lot of businesses from moving into France, from setting up shop, from growing, from hiring more people if they think that things are going to go well, because they know that France's labor laws make it almost impossible to get rid of anyone as the economy gets worse or as times go bad. And anytime any economic problems come up, well, the government just responds with a kind of knee-jerk, unthinking reaction that looks at effects and symptoms and doesn't bother at all with causes. For example, Amazon moves into France in the way that it has in Britain and in America, and French independent bookshops start to struggle. And instead of looking at, okay, well, why are bookshops struggling? Or even saying, well, okay, consumers now have more access to cheap books than they've ever had before. On balance, that may well be a good thing, or at least we should let consumers decide whether that's a good thing or not. Instead, they jumped in there and just started passing regulations. So one of the regulations that they passed is they outlawed free delivery. And I enjoyed Amazon's response, which was to charge 1 euro cent for delivery to get around that law. But it is holding France and then France back. They've even made it now basically illegal for Amazon to discount books. And the government is setting the price for books, independent or like bricks and mortar stores. They can discount books. I believe it's by about 20%. Amazon is banned from doing so. And it's this kind of constant tinkering with the economy that makes it so hard to do business in France. It's the kind of logic that, I don't know, that looks at the invention of the car and says, oh, well, this is going to lead to stable hands going out of business and stables shutting down and anybody that's involved with looking after horses, we must ban it. And no wonder they're having trouble with their economy moving forwards. And Emmanuel Macron, he does want to do something about this. He wants to address these regulation problems. He wants to try and bring corporate tax rates down. He wants to loosen up France's 35-hour working week, legislation designed to make it harder to have employees work more than 35 hours, and that this greatly increases overtime costs. But he wants to start doing that. But the old ways of doing with all the cumbersome regulations, they're popular. And as you saw, as we talked about, Emmanuel Macron really is not. He doesn't really have a mandate to go in and make these changes. It's going to be very hard for him. Now, a lot of this comes down to that election in June, whether he can, if he wins a majority, if he can pull that off, which would be a huge achievement. If he can pull that off, well, then things could be quite different. And he does have, he will be in a much, much stronger position. But as it is, it seems very unlikely that he's going to be able to make these changes. Which brings to his second line of attack, the European Union, and changing the Eurozone. He said that the Eurozone in its current form, it's kind of like a half pregnancy, that it can't work like this. It's got to be all or nothing. And he's exactly right on that. That is a good chunk of the reason why the Eurozone is not working right now. And so when it comes to all or nothing, he wants all. He wants closer cooperation. He wants a Eurozone treasury. He wants a Eurozone finance minister. He wants Eurozone nations giving up a good substantial portion of their tax revenue to Europe. He's calling for a European superstate, basically. That's what it amounts to. And I think he could be right. I mean, this is a solution. It's either that or completely fall apart. And maybe it's Macron's solution that the EU ultimately accepts. But I think it would be quite a rough road before they get there. It's going to be it's a tough ask for Germany now to get them to agree to that. And a lot of it, as I said, depends on how well Macron does in June and how strong he is coming on from that election. But Bloomberg View, they wrote, talking about his solution to the Eurozone, they write that he's right, but that's exactly what Germany doesn't want. Magnificent as she believes the election result to be, Merkel was quick to add that, quote, German support cannot replace French policymaking, and her officials said Germany wouldn't be dropping its long-standing opposition to Eurobonds, or to a key plank in what Macron wants to do. And this Bloomberg View article goes on to write, talk about how Macron, he won the election in a very different way to the Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte, who he kind of dealt with anti-European sentiment in the Netherlands by moving to the anti-European side. Macron didn't do that. And this Bloomberg View article states, this shows the strength of the French elite's commitment to deeper integration. If Germany isn't alarmed about that, it should be. Merkel's dilemma will soon be apparent. Macron, with unsteady parliamentary backing at best, will struggle to get his way in Paris. So the French structural reforms that he promised and Merkel is calling for will be hard to deliver. This will raise the stakes for EU political reform. Gains in that area will matter more for Macron, yet be harder for Merkel to justify to her own voters. If she continues to resist Macron's proposal, she'll embarrass the new president and further inflame French Euroscepticism. If she gives way, her own Eurosceptics will be energized. So it starts to put Germany in a very tough position. Politico, they had a similar article, and this is just 16 hours, I think it was, that they wrote after the election. And it's called Emmanuel Macron's EU Honeymoon. Nice while it lasted. And they write, for about 16 hours, Emmanuel Macron was the darling of the European Union. Then the warning shots began to go up in Brussels and in capitals across the continent. European leaders who rejoiced at Macron's victory suddenly found themselves confronted with a president-elect of France with clear ideas about reforming the EU and the political capital to put those ideas in motion. He is a new and unpredictable force. And it points out that already leaders in Europe are speaking out against him. Mark Rutte, he said there are elements in the views of the new French president which we find less attractive. And he quite strongly criticized the euro treasury that Macron wants to bring about. One veteran French member of the European Parliament, Alain Lamoussoure, he said in 6 months he will be a great diplomat and a warlord. That's what he aims to be, going to war basically with Europe. Ambrose Evans-Pritchard talked about the same trend. He had an article called Volcanic Macron Forces Germany to Come Clean on Its Real EU Agenda. And he writes, Emmanuel Macron's lightning conquest of France has put Germany in an awkward spot. French voters have picked an apostle of Europe and an arch defender of the Franco-German axis. While this is welcomed with jubilation by some in Berlin, it raises thorny questions that others would prefer left unanswered. He goes over some of the same material that we've discussed about Macron's economic plans, and how that it, quote, it implies a unitary Eurozone superstate. That's what Macron wants. This is called Berlin's bluff, he writes. The German elites often argue that they cannot accept such radical proposals as long as other Eurozone states scoff at budgetary rules and fail to put their house in order. Whether Germany's real motive is to protect its mercantilist interest as a creditor power and run monetary union to suit itself is conveniently never put to the test. And talks about how quickly in Germany people are becoming opposed to Macron. Handelsblatt accused him of Teuton bashing. They're against a lot of the debt pooling. And he, Ambrose Evans-Pritchard writes that Mr. Macron's plans would require a new EU treaty, opening a can of worms that several states are determined to avoid. Berlin has no intention of sharing Italy's debts, whatever France does. Germany's top court says EMU fiscal union and debt pooling would require a change to the country's constitution. Politically, this is absolutely impossible, said Heiner Flassbeck, a former economy minister and now at Hamburg University. Macron would have to be a magician to turn around the Christian Democrats on this. It's in their genes to think Germany is right on the substance of all this. I don't see much chance that they will do anything serious. They may agree to boost Juncker plan for to the Juncker plan for investment and give away 20 billion to calm the situation, but that won't make any difference. François Hollande was not able to get the Germans to change. I doubt that Macron will either. The only thing that will force Germany to budge is if the French and Italians form a coalition and threaten to leave the euro. So you see this a crisis building really with Europe, and as I said, I think Macron's solution is the euro is it may well be the solution that the eurozone ends up going with, the final end to this crisis. But it's not one that Germany is going to agree with willingly, and the conditions that Germany will require are not ones that France is going to agree with easily either. So even though I think it's what he's putting forward is really much is really the way that Europe's going to go, it's a tough road to get there. It's going to take a bigger crisis than we have right now to push that through. And I think it'll be they'll very quickly reach deadlock with Germany as he tries to put forward this issue. Now, as it is, he's not going to be able to even address this issue until after the German elections in September. So we'll certainly have to wait a few months to see exactly how this plays out. But it looks like the economic crisis that France is saddled with is just going to continue, and that's going to continue to feed in to the political crisis. But another crisis with France that also is just going to build and continue is its Muslim crisis. Right on at the same time that before the first round of the elections, French political candidates were holding their very last presidential debate, you had a terrorist attack on the Champs-Élysées, where a terrorist put an AK-47 through the window of a police van and started shooting. And you know, this has become the new normal for France. They've been under a state of emergency since January 2015. Over two years now, Muslim terrorists since that time have killed 240. The Daily Signal wrote that the French people have adapted to living with the terror threat and the state's protective measures against it as part of life's normal background din. They wrote that it's no longer extraordinary to observe armed military patrols weaving among the hordes of selfie stick wielding tourists below the Eiffel Tower. Similarly, an army squad with weapons driven down the Renaissance era Cour Mirabeau in the southern city of Hauts-de-Provence on Wednesday hardly drew a single turned head from the scores of cafe revelers enjoying the shaded sidewalk terraces. And Macron has no solution to this. When that terrorist attack happened during those presidential debates, his response was just to say, well, we're going to have to put up with this for years to come. Years to come. And he said that the night a Paris police officer was murdered by a man with a Quran in his car, a note praising the Islamic State in his pocket. But the Islamic terrorism, it's not something that you can just ignore as president and hope that it's going to go away. And at the same time, Europe seems set now for a worsening migration crisis. the former British foreign minister, he wrote an article in The Telegraph yesterday where he said the crisis most likely to overwhelm Europe in the coming years and bring populist or nationalist leaders like Marine Le Pen to power is an uncontrollable rise in immigration from Africa and the Middle East. In the corridors of Brussels and other capitals, much time is spent on the issue, he wrote, but always to find sticking plaster solutions, such as buying Turkish cooperation, rather than a long-term strategy. Left to develop, the future migration crisis is the one that will break the Schengen zone, the EU, and the mainstream leaders of Europe. There is no sign that enough action is being taken to avert it. Macron should add preparing for this to his list of what needs to be done. If not, the populist leading Marine Le Pen will be back with a vengeance. And the person writing this, and it's not even a journalist or just someone making observations, it's the former British foreign minister. Someone with real experience working on exactly this solution or this problem with European leaders. These are problems that Macron openly admits he has no solution for. And these have been major influences in what has pushed so many millions to voting for the National Front, for so many millions voting for nobody or spoiling their ballot. Now, France, they're suffering from the same problems that are hitting Britain, that are hitting America. In some ways, like I said, the economic problems are really even worse because they've just gone so much more towards the left and towards socialism. All of these... just all about all Western-style democracies have problems with radical Islam. Well, they all, even Britain and America, we all have a tendency to vote for socialist policies that we just can't afford. And just about all of these countries, they have political systems that have extremists, and we'll talk about a bit of that in Britain in the next segment. Extremists and upstarts from the left, from the right. But in the Eurozone, the situation is really aggressive or uniquely bad because the leaders don't have the ability, even the means, to fix the problem, even if they knew the solution. France's borders, when it comes to Islam and migration, France's economy, when it comes to the Eurozone, a lot of that is beyond its control. It's handed that over to Europe. And the kind of rule-by-committee European Union that we have right now can't solve those problems. And so it's clear that these crises are just going to drag on. And this isn't just a French problem, it's an Italian problem. Italy spent the last few years desperately trying to avoid elections, cobbling together different coalition governments as they lose one prime minister after another. Greece causes a panic just about every time it holds an election every few years. And even the Netherlands, that's far outside of southern Europe's danger zone, caused the world to hold its breath back in March when they held an election. So Europe, you've just got this rolling crisis going through Europe. Where is it leading? Well, throughout history, you know, democracy is not as vulnerable and as stable as we like to think it is. In Europe, democracy is only a few decades old in so many places. And it's becoming clear that what was once unthinkable, it's now becoming a strong possibility. And the Bible says that this kind of end of a democratic system, this is what Europe is heading for. In his book, A Strong German Leader is Imminent, Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry talked exactly about this. And he was drawing from prophecies in Daniel chapter 8. And he points out that in Daniel chapter 8 and verse 17, it says that this is for the time at the end. And verse 19, it is for the last end. So this is talking about things that weren't for the time of Daniel, but for the time of the end. And he talks about this in his book on Daniel, the book of Daniel Unsealed at Last, which you can get for free on our website. You can just click at the literature request tab at the top right-hand corner. But in this, going back to this A Strong German Leader is Imminent booklet, he talks about, notice this strong leader who will come to the end, come on the world scene in Europe. And Daniel 8 verse 23 says, and in the latter times of their kingdom, when the transgressors are come to the full, a king of fierce countenance and understanding dark sentences shall stand up. Mr. Flory writes, God calls this leader a king. This soon coming ruler could literally be called a king. Even if not, the Bible gives him that label. When the Bible talks about a king, in most cases, it's saying this is not a democratic government. Even if he doesn't have that title, he's going to lead like a king. This vision in Daniel shows that Europe, the European Empire, is about to become a lot more authoritative. That's where this complete political breakdown in France, in the Netherlands, all across Europe is leading. Just continuing from this booklet, Mr. Floyd writes that Daniel 11:21 prophesies that this strong leader will come to power by flatteries, probably not with votes, but through a coalition government of some kind. We need to watch Germany and Europe carefully, he writes. Although the Bible prophecy gives us the outline, he continues, of how it will unfold, we don't know the details. But this then is where Europe's crisis is leading. It's where if you just watch and are honest with yourself about where events on the ground are going, it's where you can see it's leading. It's where the Bible says that it's leading as well. And you can get that book, A Strong German Leader is Imminent. You can read that. You can order that, and we'll send that anywhere in the world for free from our website, thetrumpet.com. You can just click on the literature request tab, as I said, at the top right-hand corner. We'll take a quick break now. When we come back, we'll talk about the elections that Britain is going through as well right now.
The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma. Herbert W. Armstrong long forecast the arrival of a military superpower in Europe. In a world where European nations can't rely on the United States, one in which they fear Russia and face the constant threat of radical terror, their only hope of survival is to band together. This is what we see happening, and what we see happening was prophesied in your Bible. Request Germany and the Holy Roman Empire to learn about the history of Germany and the Holy Roman Empire and to understand where the events in Europe today are leading. 3,000 years ago, the prophet Daniel explained that at the time of the end, radical Islam would push against Europe. That time is now. We are witnessing the first manifestations of this Islamist push against Europe, and it's leading to a spectacular clash between these two prophesied kings, the King of the North and the King of the South. What does the Bible say about the identity of these two kings? What about the end time? Will everyone be affected by these events? Request our two booklets, The King of the South and Germany and the Holy Roman Empire. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily.
Hello and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Stephen Flurry. Now, we're talking about the French election and some dangerous trends there. But Britain is also having an election, and there are some dangerous trends in the British election as well. I didn't play many clips for you during that first half, but we've got plenty for you in this second half. And if you've not been following British politics, I think you'll be very surprised at how extreme, how dangerous some of the leaders in this British election are. Now, over the last few days, key leaders have been caught saying a few untruths, or at least contradicting themselves. One of these dangerous leaders, who we'll talk a bit more about, Jeremy Corbyn, who's the terrorist-supporting leader of the Labour Party, he gave, and the Labour Party, and it's important to understand as we get into this, this is basically Britain's equivalent of the Democratic Party. This is the main left-wing party in Britain. This is the party that that governed Britain from 1996 on well into the 2000s. A major, significant party. Now, the big thing, or one of the big things that's got him in the news just over the last couple of days is, he gave an interview with BuzzFeed where he said that he would stay on as leader of the Labour Party even if the Labour Party were thoroughly defeated in the upcoming election. Then, just a bit later, he gave an interview with the BBC, and this time he told them that he never said that. Here's the clip from that BBC interview.
Your closest political colleague, John McDonnell, said it was inevitable that you and he would resign if you lose at a general election. Is he right? Would you resign?
We're planning to win the general election, so the question doesn't arise.
Well, the question arose when John McDonnell said it. And you told a different media outlet that you would stay on.
The question doesn't arise because we're campaigning this election to win it.
You have told other media outlets that,
no,
that you would stay on.
I would carry on as leader because we've won the election by then.
So you heard it, you told other outlets? No, he said. Nope, didn't tell them that. Well, then after that, BuzzFeed released the audio of their interview with Jeremy Corbyn. Here's that audio now.
So, and forgive me for asking this, I know you're in it to win it. If it goes wrong, if for whatever reason, in a month's time, you don't get to walk into Downing Street, is this the one shot that people have to vote for Jeremy Corbyn?
I was elected leader of this party, and I'll stay leader of this party.
So you're going to stay leader of this party no matter what happens?
I'm carrying on.
So quite a clear contradiction there. One news outlet saying, well, yep, nope, I never said that. And BuzzFeed then released the audio. You can listen for yourself where he said, whatever happens, I'm carrying on. Now, the Labour Party under Jeremy Corbyn's response has been to ban BuzzFeed from covering many Labour events. And they're just attacking that particular news outlet. So a very worrying attitude and cavalier attitude to the truth with the Labour Party. It's something that gets worse as we start to dig into it. You heard John McDonnell mentioned there, the deputy Labour leader, the shadow chancellor of the Exchequer. That basically means this is Labour's kind of candidate for running the economy, the one that's meant to be in charge of Labour's economic policies, tax, spending, etc. And here's an interview that he gave very recently on the BBC.
So a very, very clear, simple question. Are you a Marxist?
Right. I believe there's a lot to learn.
No or a yes. I couldn't work it out.
Well, I tell you, I believe there's a lot to learn from reading Capital. Yes, of course it is. And that's been recommended, not just by me, but many others, mainstream economists as well. But I also believe in the long tradition of the Labour Party.
So are you a Marxist? No. Well, here's a slightly different clip from an earlier speech.
Do we change the system? We've got to demand systemic change. I'm honest with Pete. I'm a Marxist. You know, this is a classic crisis of the economy, classic capitalist crisis. I've been waiting for this for a generation. For Christ's sake, don't waste it. You know, let's use this to explain to people this system based on greed and profit does not work. What we need is a system based upon planning for need and democratically controlled.
There we go. I'm honest with people. I'm a Marxist. Until he's asked about it on the BBC. But this is the kind of people that are running, that are the number two party in Britain, that are running to try and lead the country. And we talked about when we're talking about the crisis in France, what it says when the National Front, this far right or far left, it's kind of in both of those. But when this party can win a third of the vote, what it says about where France is going, where Europe is going. Well, it also says something very important about Britain when one of Britain's top two parties is led by communists, where one says, look, I'm a Marxist, and then lies about it on national television. Now, it does seem to be fair that they're set to lose the election by a landslide. They're polling on, I think, a little under 30% compared to the Conservatives that are on 45, 46, I think I even saw 47% in a recent poll. But it's an extreme party. And it says a lot that such an important party, such a major party, has become so extreme. And here's a couple more. Well, here's another clip we'll just hear from John McDonnell. Again, this is Labour's deputy leader, the one that wants to run the one that they're putting forward, saying this is the guy formulating our economic policies. And here's another exposure, exposition of what he thinks.
The whole point of many of our movements now is to recognise parliamentary democracy doesn't work for us. Elections aren't working for us. We're going to this next general election, and yes, we'll seek to campaign, we'll seek to get people in power who may seek to represent us. But what's happening is elected dictatorships. Democracy is about taking control of your own community. And that means industrial action combined with direct action. We used to call it insurrection. Now we're polite and say it's direct action. Let's get back to calling it what it is. It's insurrection. We want to bring this government down by whatever that means to the
election. That's a couple of clips from a speech he gave before the last election, but there he is calling for insurrection. We need to bring this government down through insurrection. Here's just another quick clip exposing his thinking.
And that gives us, again, another opportunity in the same way the financial crisis helps us. You see, I don't want to just bring down the government anymore. I want to destroy the system. Because it is a system...
I don't just want to bring down the government, he says. I want to destroy the system. Destroy the system. This is an out-and-out radical communist. A few years ago, someone asked him who had been most significant in developing your political thinking. And he said, the fundamental Marxist writers of Marx, Lenin, and Trotsky. These are his most influential political thinkers, Marx, Lenin, and Trotsky. He said that they taught him how, quote, you can't change the world through the parliamentary system. That's what he believes. You can't change the world through the parliamentary system. You need insurrection. You need to bring down the system. During the Troubles, when terrorists attacking Britain during the 80s and 90s, and he talked about, he said that the ballot, the bullet and the bomb would unite Ireland. He was inciting and encouraging violence and terrorist attacks against his own country. Andrew Roberts, I've quoted him a few times on this program. He's one of my favorite modern historians. He had an article in The Telegraph talking about some of the others in kind of the Labour Party retinue. He talked about there's Jane Fisher, who is Corbyn's, quote, stakeholder engagement manager. And she was the former manager of Sinn Féin's London office. And Sinn Féin, if you're not familiar with them, they're the political arm of Ireland's terrorist group, the IRA. Seamus Milne, his press advisor, he's argued that, quote, for all its brutalities and failures, communism in the Soviet Union, Eastern Europe and elsewhere delivered rapid industrialization, mass education, job security, and huge advances in social and gender equality. It's crazy that anyone in modern politics can get away with saying something. Stalin killed more people than Hitler. And it would quite rightly be the end of anyone's political career if they said, well, for all of Nazism's failings, it delivered rapid industrialization, mass education, job security, etc. Yet they have people right at the top of the party that have said this about Stalin. There's James Schneider, who leads Momentum, which is an internal Labour Party group that is supportive of Jeremy Corbyn. He's talked about how much he enjoys seeing the police beaten by far-left demonstrators. Andrew Roberts, he writes, these are not the hapless activists of the Citizen Smith sitcom. They are unpleasant and dangerous people who applaud Corbyn's invitation of the IRA leadership to tea at the House of Commons. We'll hear a little bit about that in a second. Only weeks after it nearly assassinated Margaret Thatcher. We heard from Diane Abbott a few days ago. Mr. Flurry played a clip from her. And, here's an older... an infamous clip from her on a BBC TV show.
Why is that? Why is it right to wear a Maoist T-shirt, but obviously wrong, as it is, to wear a Hitler T-shirt?
I suppose some people will judge that on balance, Mao did more good than harm. You can't say that about the Nazis.
What was the good? Remind me what the good
bit
was.
Serious,
well, it's funny. I just had this debate with my son.
I wish this were in private time.
Well, I just had this debate with my son.
Like all these old lefty dictators. Mao killed tens of millions of people.
Yeah, just tell me, what was the good that he did that made up for the 60 million people he murdered?
He led his country from feudalism. He helped to defeat the Japanese. And he left his country on the verge...
Frank could have beaten the Japanese too.
No, well, and he left his country on the verge of the, you know, the great economic success they're having now.
And it's not just Diane Abbott. John McDonnell, he brought Mao's Red Book to a debate in the House of Commons. And when it comes to the list of humans that have killed other humans, Mao is number one in history. Killed more people, responsible for more deaths than anyone else ever. I think 60 to 100 million is that's the kind of the general regarded ballpark. And you have the people at the top of a major party in the UK while saying, well, that's okay because he brought his country out of feudalism. I think it says a lot about the state of education in this country that kind of thing is even tolerated. And then you heard, about saying, well, Mao defended China against the Japanese, which is just, again, Chiang Kai-shek defended China against the Japanese and his nationalists and the Kuomintang party. I mean, they were the ones that sacrificed a lot of their blood, really, to tie the Japanese down in China, and played a major role in the Allied victory in World War II. And the communists basically sat it out because they figured, well, the Japanese, they're injuring the nationalists. The nationalists are spending all their blood and treasure fighting the Japanese. They basically sat it out and then took over once the war was over. And to our great shame, in the West, we did nothing to help out Chiang Kai-shek, who'd done so much to help us during the war. But you have, Diane Abbott is the shadow Home Secretary. She's the one that the Labour Party are putting forward as their kind of representative. This is the type of person we want in charge of the police. This is the person that's in charge of formulating our policies for what we would want to do in charge of the police, in charge of the security services, in charge of MI5, in charge of the judiciary. And it's somebody who says, oh, well, Chairman Mao, on balance, they may have done more good than harm. If they weren't, we heard last week with Diane Abbott's lack of complete understanding how numbers work. And if they weren't so inept, it would be even more terrifying to put this kind of person forward. And then you have Jeremy Corbyn itself, a genuine, the number two candidate to be Britain's prime minister, the leader of Britain's main left-wing party. And here's what he had to say about Hezbollah and Hamas.
I want to first of all say thank you everyone for being here tonight, and say that tomorrow evening it will be my pleasure and my honour to host an event in Parliament where our friends from Hezbollah will be speaking. I'd also invited the friends from Hamas to come and speak as well. Unfortunately, the Israelis would not allow them to travel here, so it's going to be only friends from Hezbollah. So far as I'm concerned, that is absolutely the right function of using parliamentary facilities to invite people from other parts of the world. So that we can promote that peace, that understanding, and that dialogue. And the idea that an organization that is dedicated towards the good of the Palestinian people and bringing about long-term peace and social justice and political justice in the whole region should be labeled as a terrorist organization by the British government is really a big, big historical mistake. And I would invite the government to reconsider its position on this matter and start talking directly to Hamas and Hezbollah. That is the only way forward to bring about peace.
And I'm sure I don't need to rehearse on this show the crimes, the murders of Hezbollah and Hamas. And he's there calling them our friends, inviting them to the Houses of Parliament. And this is a man, he's appeared on Iranian press TV, taken money to appear to present a show, I think it was, even on Iran's government-run press TV, participating in the propaganda of an enemy nation, a nation that talks about wanting to wipe Israel off the map, that calls America the Great Satan, that has called Britain the Little Satan, and he'll take money from their government and appear on their TV. An enemy, really, of his own country. Here's just a clip from the Labour leadership debates where the moderator there just did, a great job of calling him out on just the crazy things that he's done and said in the past.
Jeremy Corbyn, you've invited Hezbollah, Hamas, the IRA to Parliament in the past. You've called them your friends. Is there any terrorist group beyond the pale for a cosy chat on the House of Commons terrace with you?
I invited a number of groups to discuss the Middle East into a meeting in Parliament and welcomed everyone to that meeting as friends because they were coming in prepared to have a serious discussion.
On Northern Ireland, you didn't just deal with Sinn Féin. You dealt with the IRA 3 weeks after the Brighton bomb, in which the IRA had tried to destroy the democratically elected government of this country. You invited two convicted IRA terrorists to the House of Commons.
They were former prisoners who had come out of prison, women who had come out of prison, came to Parliament, actually in a meeting that had been arranged long before, to talk about prison conditions and rehabilitation of prisoners.
They were IRA.
Is there anything wrong with that since they had a spent conviction?
They had their organisation had just tried to blow up the British government.
So you have a terrorist group tries to destroy the British government, and just a few weeks later he invites their members to come to Parliament. And as I said, just, you know, he's not, while it seems very unlikely, but it's scarily possible, it's very unlikely, it seems, that he's going to win the election and be Britain's next Prime Minister, but he is the candidate for the Labour Party. And like I said, just like the rise of Le Pen says some important things about France, about all of Europe, the fact that these people are leading a major political party, that says something about the state of Britain right now. These are truly dangerous people, and they've taken over this significant party. It's a dangerous trend in both Britain and America. A few weeks ago, Trumpet managing editor Joel Hilliker made a video for the Trumpet called "How Did Socialism Become So Popular in America?" He was focusing obviously with the title on America, but it's a trend we see both in Britain and America. And here's a short clip from that video.
When you look at the leaders in the Democratic Party today, they got their education from universities that were heavily influenced by communist thinkers. In 1970, there was actually a KGB agent who defected from the Soviet Union, and he exposed in detail a plot by the Soviet Union to wage a stealth attack against the United States. He talked about ideological subversion, mostly aimed at American schools, specific methods including infiltrating universities with radical leftists, and establishing newspapers staffed by communists. That's not a conspiracy theory. Go ask the average college professor if he's a socialist or a Marxist, and chances are he or she will tell you, yes, I am. The Communist Party USA enlisted the support of thousands of sympathetic professors. Documents from Soviet archives reveal that even after the Soviet Union collapsed, the Communist Party USA received $2 to $3 million a year from the Kremlin. Former President Barack Obama was influenced as a youth by Frank Marshall Davis, a card-carrying Communist Party member, a man who openly supported Joseph Stalin and who said the world's greatest threat was Anglo-American imperialist domination. Mr. Obama wrote in his biography that he attended socialist conferences and hung out with Marxist professors. There's a lot of evidence exposing the communists' deliberate effort to get inside the Democratic Party.
Now, it's easy to say or to point, to look at the National Front, to point at them, as we did at the start of this show, and say, look, they contain people that have excused the Holocaust, that deny certain events that happened there. But even they don't try and excuse Adolf Hitler or extol his good points. And I think there's a strong case that the people that are running the Labour Party and the people that, as you just heard about, are teaching in so many of Britain and America's schools are even worse, even more extreme than Le Pen, than the National Front. When they say things like, oh yeah, well, I support Marx and Engels and Trotsky. You know, the Black Book of Communism is a thoroughly well-researched book. It's a thick book. I have it in my office, and it goes through and it tries to tally up the total number of deaths that have been brought about by that ideology. It comes to about 200 million. 200 million. And sure, it does say something about France when you can have a third of people vote for a party as extreme as the National Front. These guys are even more extreme. These ones in Britain, they're even more popular. And they have the support of so much of the intelligentsia, of the universities behind them. At the end of that video that we heard a clip from, Mr. Hillock appointed readers to Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flory's book, Great Again. And in that book, again, it's more focused on America, but so much of this applies to Britain. He wrote, what happens to a nation when the people come to expect their leaders to lie, when people embrace defeat? This is a far deadlier crisis than most people realize. And we see that same kind of rise in lying. We looked at some of these sound bites where politicians were caught contradicting themselves at the start of this segment. But he also goes in about how this is a grave concern. He said during the Cold War, there was a lot of fear within America about the spread of communism. Today, most Americans no longer consider it a threat of any concern. But it is of grave concern. Few people realize it, but many mainstream political views in America today are identical to and traced directly back to the ideals and beliefs of communism or Marxism. And in the UK, well, they don't even talk about it. He talked about how many fail to understand the dangers that accompany communism and accompany a communist system. And when you can have a deputy leader of the party that says, I'm a Marxist, well, that's certainly true of the UK. He writes, modern proponents of communism downplay its subversive goals. But subversion is its very foundation. The Communist Manifesto by Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels is considered the sacred text of communism. It stresses the need for a total overthrow of existing governments. The manifesto concludes with some words that may sound eerily familiar to modern news watchers. Let the ruling classes tremble at the communist revolution. The proletariat have nothing to lose but their chains. They have a world to win. And this is the kind of thing, rhetoric, that you see even coming from John McDonnell. We need to smash the whole system, not just politics, not just elections. And when you have leaders of one of your main parties that fundamentally believe that your country is evil, their country is evil, that support terrorists that attack their own country, that's a real danger. That's a huge danger that you have so many 20, 25, 30% supporting that. That's a major danger to your country. And it says something, like Mr. Flurry talked about yesterday, about your country's education system. You can read much more about it in Mr. Flurry's book, Great Again. Go on that and on the literature request tab on our website, thetrumpet.com. Get your free copy. As I said, we'll ship that for free all around the world. Now, that's about all that I have time for on today. Thanks for listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. And please tune in tomorrow. Listen again as Mr. Stephen Flurry is back on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show.